are listening to the preaching ministry of Faith Baptist Church.
Romans chapter 6 is going to be our focus for the next few months, and I am excited about that. Today we will not split into our men and ladies groups this afternoon. We are going to have a little extra information on the front end to give you some background to the book of Romans and get us oriented. We want to make sure today we stay on time to make sure our new schedule runs smoothly. But we will split up into men and ladies groups at the end of the morning session as we normally do, beginning next Sunday. Romans chapter 6. Does anyone know what book in the Bible this passage is in? Romans, yes, just wanting to make sure you're paying attention. I remember in college one time, one of the questions on one of our exams was, we had to give the chapter content for almost every chapter in the New Testament for an exam. And so they would tell us John chapter 10, or Romans chapter 4, or Revelation chapter 2, and we had to give a general category from memory of what was in that chapter. And I remember as a teacher giving the same questions, and one of the questions on one of the tests was John chapter 3. People would look at that and say, they couldn't remember John chapter 3. What was in John chapter 3? Can anyone tell me what's in John chapter 3? You know John 3:16, right? So if I say John 3... who is he talking to? Nicodemus. So, yeah, it's not hard. We actually all, for the most part, know that. Sometimes we don't know what is most obvious, so we have to make sure. Let's talk about the book of Romans briefly so that you have the background of this passage. We will not go through this every Sunday, just today. The book of Romans was written by the Apostle Paul, and he wrote to believers who were in Rome. The church or churches that were in the city of Rome, that is who he wrote this letter to. Now, there are two purposes for this book, and we usually focus on the second purpose, and we will get there, but often we overlook the first purpose, and the first purpose helps bring this very rich doctrinal book down to earth and puts it in a real life context, which is very helpful, and we often overlook this. So I want to share this. Look up Romans 1:11 and then 15:23-24. Romans 1:11 and then 15:23-24. And I'll need someone to read nice and loud, maybe one man and one lady, each of these two verses. Susanna 1:11.
For I long to see you, that I may impart to you some spiritual gift, so that you may be established.
And 15:23-24. Lewis? So here's what Paul is doing. Paul had not yet been to Rome. And so the only people that he knew in the churches in Rome were people he had met in other cities to the east, in cities like Jerusalem and Ephesus and Thessalonica, cities that were in either Eastern Europe, Asia Minor, Turkey area, or Jerusalem, Palestine. Those are where he may have met some people because Rome was like New York City in a lot of ways. It was the center hub of the Roman Empire. There's a lot of coming and going. So some people that he met some places would have moved or traveled or been to Rome, and they were a part of that church there. The longer you are a Christian, the more Christians you know in other churches, even if you've never been to some of those churches. And so that's where Paul was at. At the same time, there were a lot of people, Christians, that he'd heard about or he knew were there that he had never met himself. So Paul wanted to go to Rome and visit the people there. After all, he was the Apostle Paul, and to have a personal impact in the church at Rome would have been an important thing to accomplish. And so he wanted to get there, and he wanted to minister to that church just like he was doing in churches to the east. And so he begins introducing the letter this way: I am looking forward to going and visiting you and ministering to you a spiritual gift. And then he doesn't say anything more about that until Romans chapter 15. And it's as though he came back to his original thought. And in Romans 15, we find out this continues. Oh, by the way, he says, I do want to come and visit you. I know I've not made it there yet. I have other things I have to do. I'm busy. But I do want to go to Rome. I actually want to visit you. And not only do I want to give you something that I do as an apostle, minister to you spiritually, I also want to get something from you. I actually hope that you can help me financially, because I want to go to Spain, which, if you know your geography, Palestine is to the east, Turkey, Asia Minor is a little to the west, Eastern Europe is to the west of that, Rome is to the west of that. He hadn't been there yet. And where is Spain? To the west of that. And so what he's doing is he's preparing the way for him to visit Rome. And if he was going to go all the way to Rome, he wanted that church to do more than have heard about him through other people. He wanted them to know him personally and as much as possible, so that when he did eventually make the effort to go all the way to Rome, they would already have a confidence in him, welcome him, and then be able to help him financially go farther west. He was counting on their strategic partnership to fund him and get him to Spain. But he knew he couldn't get to Rome at that time. And so what he's doing is he's kind of paving the way. It would be like this today. It'd be like us knowing about a missionary who wants to go to a certain country. We know about him because a couple people in the church know him from the past somehow. But he actually wants to go somewhere else, and he's counting on us to help him. But he knows most of us don't know him that personally yet, just a few of us. And a few of us have some ideas about him that might be questionable. And I'll get to that in a second. And so he decides, since I can't go there now, and I don't want the first time that I go there to be the first time they actually got to know me, then I'm going to write a letter to them. And I'm going to share my heart with them. And I'm going to get ahead of myself and pave the way for myself to visit them in the future, so that when I get there, it will be like they know me, and we can get the ball rolling a little faster like that. That's the idea. And so the practical reason for this letter is that Paul was writing to a church he hadn't been to before to clear up misconceptions about his teaching, to create a familiarity with his ministry, to build a bridge for him to eventually go to Rome, so that those believers would be able to help him eventually go to Spain. And he's kind of hoping that when he showed up in Rome, that point would be the launching point to go to Spain. He wouldn't have to go back to the east again and raise more money and then go back to Rome and all of this kind of thing. So he begins at the beginning of the letter. He resumes this at the end of the letter. Can you see the diplomacy already as well? I wish that I could come to you to give you a spiritual gift. And then by the end, I hope that you can give me a gift and help me. Do you see that? What he's doing there? There's a lot of diplomacy and foresight going into this. Now, that leads us to really what we know this letter for, and that's everything in between. This is the longest letter that Paul wrote, and the most intricate, logically, theologically developed letter. There's other letters he wrote that are theologically rich, but not this extensive, and not this organized as Rome. He wrote this for the practical purpose which we've discussed, but embedded in that was a theological purpose, and that was to present the gospel. I had a preacher on Facebook ask, and I didn't answer because I don't know that you can answer this question, asked the question in a pastor's chat group this week. He said, How do you give the gospel in 60 seconds or less? And I felt like posting something sarcastic. You ever feel like posting something sarcastic online and you catch yourself? Think, that's online. I can't do that. I felt like posting, you can't give the gospel in 60 seconds or less. You can't do that. You can summarize, but you can't give. Paul gives the gospel in 16 chapters in depth in the book of Romans. And you don't have to get that in depth every time you explain the gospel to somebody. But that's what he does, essentially, in this letter. Some people wonder, perhaps, so in the New Testament, if I have the gospel according to Matthew, and I have the gospel according to Mark, and the gospel according to Luke, and the gospel according to John, well, what about the gospel according to Paul? This is the gospel according to Paul. If you want to know what Paul thought about the gospel, you turn to the book of Romans, and he explains it to you in detail. This is not the gospel for dummies. This is the gospel for people who want to know everything there is to know about the gospel. That's what the book of Romans is. It's not an easy read. It's understandable, but it's going to require you to pray and to think again and to really think. Break it down. That's what the book of Romans does. And we're not going to go through the entire book of Romans right now. We're going to focus on a certain section. Now, one of the reasons why Paul did this from a practical standpoint, one of the reasons why he gave the gospel so extensively was because in Rome, as in other places, people had some misconceptions about Paul's teachings. They believed that he might have been peddling a gospel that had some problems. That's what false teachers were saying about him. They believed that he was, in particular, one of two things, at least. One, that he was favoring the Jews or the Gentiles. There's different takes on this. Some said that he was too Jewish-friendly. In most cases, people thought he was too Gentile-friendly and was disparaging the Jews. And in the book of Romans, he goes out of his way in the first five chapters to explain everybody is really bad. Jews are really bad. Non-Jews are really bad. Everybody's really bad. It doesn't make a difference. Everybody needs to be saved. It's all the same. Romans 9 through 11, three chapters exclusively stuck in the middle of the book to explain how this whole Jew and Gentile thing actually works out in history and in God's plan. Very complex. But that's why he's talking about it, because he's being criticized. When you put a bastard's back against the wall and you start criticizing his teaching, eventually he's going to give you a long lecture about what he actually believes, in case you want to know. And that's what Paul does. In some cases, what Paul was teaching was presented as he's subversive. He's causing rebellion and revolt in political ways. And he talks about that in Romans chapter 13. You obey those that are in the government. I do not teach people to rebel against the government, okay? Another big issue that Paul is criticized over, he was criticized for teaching licentious living. That the law has no bearing on our life today at all. And you can do whatever you want because of grace. And he was accused of that as well. He was accused of calling the law bad. And that's not true. Now, the law certainly has a very different role today than it did in the Old Testament. And we owe so much of our understanding of that to Paul. But to teach that, you do border on sounding like you're saying the law is no good. And that's what Paul was accused of. And so the book of Romans takes time, especially in the passages that we're going to look at, Romans 6 through 8, to explain why the law is not bad. He does not teach that it's bad. In fact, it's very good. It just has a very different role today than it used to. And so what Paul is doing is not just sitting down writing a gospel because he just wants to do it. He is writing it to clear out misconceptions about his teaching and his ministry and his beliefs, because he's the key voice for the New Testament church. And personally, he's doing that so that when he goes to Rome, eventually they will have confidence in his ministry and will support him to go all the way to Spain. So he's kind of clearing the way and building a bridge. Let's talk about briefly the theme of this book. People word it different ways. Is God's plan of salvation unfolded? That's the idea of the book of Romans, an in-depth explanation of God's plan of salvation. The first section of the book is usually divided up as chapters 1 through 11, and we would call that the doctrinal explanation. That is the section that Paul takes a lot of time to devote to explaining the gospel from beginning to end, the nuts and bolts of the gospel, the highs, the lows, everything in between. That is Romans 1 through 11. And that section ends with Paul basically saying, there's things I don't even understand. I've done my best to explain to you, but who can understand the depths of the knowledge of God? I've done my best. This is as close as we're going to get. But now, Romans 12, 1, it's time to move on. He says, on the basis of what I just taught you, I urge you, I beseech you. So he falls to his knees, and he says, just present yourself to God, a living sacrifice. So if you don't get to Romans 12 feeling like whatever God says to do, I will do, you do not understand Romans 1 through 11. But when you get to Romans 12, to the end of the book, he does what he usually does in his letters. He moves from laying out theology to explaining how that should apply to our daily lives. And that's what Romans 12 through 16 does. It's a practical section. Doctrinal explanation, 1 through 11. Practical application, 12 to 16. Where does our study series fall? Doctrinal explanation, right? In the middle of this section. In the doctrinal explanation, there is a section, and I already mentioned Romans 9 through 11, which is not on the slide. It's kind of like an inserted section that Paul inserts to really unpack the relationship of Jews and Gentiles and how this all works out in God's plan, how that God chose Israel and then Israel didn't believe on the Messiah, and yet he hasn't rejected them. They're still a part of his plan, but he set them to the side, and he's working through the Gentiles right now, but he's going to come back to the Jews in the future and finish what he started in the past, and everything is under control. That's what Romans 9 through 11 is all about. Nothing's off the rails. Nothing's been messed up. Everything is under control. God knows what he's doing. In this section, there is a definite progression. In the first five chapters of Romans, he talks about justification. Justification is how you get into the gospel. It's how you get into a relationship with God. It is salvation. This is a discussion about how a person, any person, Jew or Gentile, religious or pagan, how any person becomes a child of God. It's not by works. It is by grace through faith in Christ alone. It is the same for everybody. And that is Romans 1 through 5. How do you come to a right standing before God? Justification. Following that is the section we will study, a section on sanctification, how the gospel not only gets you into a relationship with God, but how you grow in that relationship with God. And that's what we're going to be discussing for the next couple of months. The gospel is not just a key to get you in. It is a map to show you how to get around once you're in. The gospel is a rule for living, not just a way to be saved. And this is the part that we often forget. And we don't know very well. We don't apply very well. And then, following that, is a final section that we call glorification, which refers to the end of our salvation. That is that day when we stand before God and every bit of sin is stripped out of our being and we are made to be like Jesus Christ completely in every way, including our physical body. So this is this process of getting in, of living out, and ending up as the gospel. And so that's Romans chapter 1 through chapter 8, a doctrinal explanation. All right, so any questions before we jump into our Romans 6, 1 through 4? I'm not going to answer that question today, just because of time and focus, but it is mentioned throughout that passage, and is the main theme of that passage. Romans 1 through 5. Yep. That is correct. Okay, so this is our passage, and this is, I hope, a passage that some of you will memorize and commit to memory. If Romans 6 through 8 is a foundation for living out the Christian life in a victorious, faithful way, why in the world would you not even consider memorizing? Isn't that an interesting question? A lot of things that are hard to memorize, a lot of things occupying your time and mind these days. But is there anything more important than knowing how to successfully live the Christian life? This is, if you want to memorize, this is something to memorize. I want to challenge you to do that. We'll have some verses to memorize in the next few months, maybe a verse a week. But I would encourage you to try to memorize the section. My wife and I are going to be doing this. I've memorized Romans 12 in the past in my life. I don't know if I could quote it all to you today. But I have not memorized Romans 6. I'm going to take that challenge, and my wife and I are going to work on that daily together and put this passage into memory. We can draw on and live it out even more effectively. This is a section we're looking at today. Paul says, and by the way, this is the response to everything he said about justification. Okay? What shall we say then? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? Certainly not. He was accused of saying that, though. How shall we who died to sin live any longer in it? Or do you not know that as many of us as were baptized into Christ Jesus were baptized into his death? Therefore we were buried with him through baptism into death, that just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, even so we also should walk in newness of life. What we're going to do is we're going to take a similar approach to these verses as we have been working on in smaller bits last quarter. Taking a verse and breaking it down and looking at key words and then thinking about the meanings of those words, which is biblical Bible study, biblical meditation and application. This is how I want us to learn the Bible and live the Bible. We won't look at every single word, but I'm going to try to point out things that are important to know. First of all, we have this phrase, what then, tiun, in Greek. And it asks the readers to offer the appropriate response to what Paul said in 5:20-21. It is the link between chapter 6 and chapters 1 through 5. The conclusion, the culmination of everything Paul said about justification is in Romans 5:20-21. Notice what it says. Moreover, end of the story, the law entered that the offense might abound, so that we would have a very clear and robust and comprehensive idea of just how bad we actually are. Without the law, you don't either know or want to agree to how bad you actually are. And so the law entered to make that abundantly clear. But where sin abounded, grace abounded much more.
When you discover how abundantly bad you are, you also discover just how completely and excessively and completely good God is. And the grace that he offers to you is. If you're walking along and a fly is flying in front of you and someone comes by and swats it out of the way, are you amazed by that? Is that just saved you? Saved you from what? Getting some germs. What? From a fly that's going to land on your nose. Okay, yes, you saved me. I appreciate it. I didn't feel like I was that much in trouble, but whatever. It's fine. You're drowning in the ocean and someone comes by and pulls you out. How do you feel about that? Great. You're very thankful to that person for saving your life. That's what the law does. You don't understand how good and gracious God is when all you think you have with your sin is a little fly. But when you realize you're actually drowning and it's that bad, you know how great the grace of God truly is. That's what the law is designed to accomplish. So, verse 21, so that as sin reigned in death, even so grace might reign through righteousness to eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord. That is amazing truth. But there were people saying, wait, read that again. Listen, here's what Paul is really saying. The more sin there is, the more grace there is. So sin as much as you can so that you can get as much grace as possible. That's what Paul was being accused of. And when you preach the gospel properly, you will get accused of this. People will say, well, isn't that an excuse to sin? I mean, if salvation is like that, well, then I could just basically do whatever I want, right? That can't be right. So it has to have something to do with me. This is an accusation that good gospel preaching will automatically receive sometimes. You have to know how to answer that. Here's what Paul says. He throws it back at him. So, what shall we say then? Should we just go on and keep on sinning so that we can have more grace? And the answer is definitely not. That's not the right response. So, this phrase, what then? He's pulling the audience in to his own problem. I get accused of this, is the idea. Well, let me put you in the seat. What would you say to that? Do you agree that this is a proper conclusion, like they said? Well, I think you would agree with me. Definitely not. And I'm going to give you reasons why that's a very silly conclusion and why I don't even subscribe to it. Continue in. Epimeno. Epimeno, you might know the Greek word meno means to abide or continue, to remain. Meno. Epi means kind of on and on, through, into. It means to stay longer, prolong a stay, remain on, persist in. The idea is, well, grace is abundant where sin is abundant, so maybe I should just keep sticking around where sin is. Just living in sin. The more I sin. There are people who have taught this straight out. They teach that do whatever you can. Just sin to the max, because that's when you really understand the grace of God. And sometimes we say stuff like this too. Well, it's good for me to mess up sometimes, because messing up helps me to appreciate grace more. That's true, but not if you set out to sin for that reason. This is what happens to us sometimes, right? We're not supposed to stay longer, prolong our stay, remain on, persisting in sin because of grace. It's not a proper conclusion. Sin. The word sin is a word that means error, offense, or sin. And in particular, it does find its meaning in its life where there's a law. You break a law. You offend a rule. The more rules there are, the more things there are to break. So just keep breaking rules, right? So you can have more grace. That's the discussion. Sin. Abound. Pleo not so. It means to come into wider action, to be more widely spread. should I keep on sinning so that I can have a much broader experience of grace? You've heard it said sometimes, he who sinned the most is forgiven most. Is that true? It is. It is true. I'm not trying to set you up. It is true. He who's forgiven most is sins most because there's more to forgive. But the conclusion of that is not, so go and sin more so you can be forgiven. No, that's not the conclusion. That's what Paul is trying to avoid. Grace, charis. We'll see this in the message today. Grace is the heart of Paul's theology. Grace is the heart of Paul's theology. He mentions grace 95 times in all of his epistles, multiple times in every single one. You cannot talk to Paul for any length of time and not hear about grace and not realize that everything he's saying is rooted in grace. Just like you can't talk to Moses without hearing about the law. Everything he says comes out of the law. That's how Paul is with grace. You could teach a whole series just on grace itself, but these chapters do unfold grace to us. It refers to God's free, unearned favor. It is a free gift. It is gracious provision or gracious dealing. Somebody walked up to you today and gave you the green handshake. You know what that is, right? Someone with a green thumb. No, not someone with a green thumb. Someone with a lot of germs in their hand because they have some cash in their hand. And you owe $10,000. And what's your first question? What did I do to deserve that? Right? Isn't that your first question? And somewhat, why did you do that for me? Why did you give that? I didn't do anything for you this last week. What is that? That's gracious provision. That's the gospel. You never do anything to earn it. It's by faith alone. That's grace. And it actually means a real need that you have. This word, certainly not, meganoito, is an emphatic denial or rejection. This is as strong of a no as you can get in Greek. Very strong. This is Paul saying, and I'm not going to do it right now, but if Paul pounded pulpits and yelled and stomped at the same time, this is about as close as you get to it. No! Mark my word. N-O. Definitely not. That's what this phrase means. The King James translation says, God forbid, which borders on actual taking God's name in vain. I'm a little nervous about saying that myself. The word God and the word forbid, neither of those words are in Greek. The literal translation of that phrase is, may it never be. That's the idea. We don't say, may it never be, so we have to think through, how do we say this today? Yeah, I guess certainly not, definitely not, in no way. Don't even go there. It's not where this goes. Not even close. That's what this phrase means. It appears three times, and you can see Romans 3, Romans 6, Romans 7. All three times, you see this phrase. Do you see how in the first doctrinal section of this book, Paul is defending himself against ideas? This is what I'm accused of. It is not the case. This is what they say. I say, I do not say this. People accuse me of teaching that. That is not true. It is definitely not true. That's what he's doing in this book. And in all of these cases, it usually has something to do with a wrong view of law and grace and how he's being wrongly accused. And he wants to make it clear, I am not teaching license. I am not disparaging the law. I am teaching the truth about grace. Strong words. Die means to die to a thing by renunciation or other separation. And that is the key of separation, being cut off, separated. Do you not know? In Greek is the word agnoeo. Agno, you see that igno, agno means being ignorant. You are ignorant, you don't understand. And it's a question, so saying, are you ignorant? Do you not understand? Well, you should know something. the idea. Don't be ignorant about this. And this is one of the reasons why we need to study Romans 6 through 8, because as a pastor, I don't want you to be ignorant of some very important truths. I don't want you to fail to understand what's at the heart and the core of the Christian life. Get off track. I don't want you to misunderstand what I teach as a pastor, or Paul taught as a New Testament apostle. Very important. You cannot be ignorant. Baptize is the word baptizo, means to dip or to immerse. Buried with is an interesting word. It means to be what? Buried with. Buried and with. That's what it means. Kind of gross, right? To be buried with somebody. Tie somebody else's corpse and place in their grave with them. It's like something out of a horror movie. Gross. You've been buried with Christ. Glory, the word doxa is a broad word. In this case, it's referring to a glorious manifestation, a glorious working. Not just what you see about God, that's, wow, amazing. It's what you see God doing that proves he is, wow, and amazing. And what is it that he did? He raised Jesus from the dead. And that is, wow, and amazing. And that reveals how great he really is when he did that. And you were a part of that. Walk, peripateo. This is a cool word in Greek, peripateo. It uses what they call automatopoeia. Is that the right word? It's a word that illustrates what it's talking about by the way it sounds. Now, we do this today when we talk about the pitter-patter of the feet, right? You ever hear the pitter-patter of the feet across the hallway? The pitter-patter of the feet. Pitter-patter illustrates, you know, the walking, right? Yeah, this is talking, peripateto. Peripateto. Walking. It refers to walking around. Sometimes in my family, some of our family members have the habit of, they can't stand still when they talk. It's like this the whole time. And finally I said, "Do you just stand still so I can talk to you? Stop." Walking around. And it's a metaphor for your conduct of life, how you live every day, how you go around and carry out your life. So we've broken down the words. We got one more. Newness, kainates, new in nature or kind, different and better than before. Let's dive in to the passage a little more. What does Paul talk about in Romans 5, 20 to 21 that prompts him to ask the opening question of Romans 6? I've kind of told you this. You tell me back. What is the thing that he said? Quote me, what did he say that he has to question now in Romans 6? Someone besides the people who've answered already. There's plenty of options here. People answer.
Law and grace, grace abounded.
Yes. Where sin abounded, grace abounded much more. That's what he said. So should we keep on sinning so that we can have more grace? That's the question. Logical. But it's not theological. It's not God's logic. That's man's logic. Silly logic. What is the first doctrinal reason Paul offers for rejecting this man's logic, this logical conclusion? What is his first reason? Romans chapter 6, verse 2. Definitely not. And then he tells you his first reason. What is it? You don't have to understand it. Just tell me what it is. You died to sin. You died to sin. You've already died to sin, which means you have been separated and cut off from the authority of sin in your life. We know this does not refer to what? Physical death. Why? Because if I walked up and pinched you, you would scream. You're still alive. All right? This is talking about a different kind of death. This is a spiritual death that happened when you were born again. You see, we understand a little bit what it means to be born again, but do we know that to be born again, you have to die first so you can be born again? And the way that you die first is you die to sin. And that's going to be described more in this passage, in death. And then you're born again to a new life. What does it mean to die to sin? It refers to being cut off, separated, and released from the authority and power of sin over our lives. I like what one commentator, a man named David Black, says this. As far as sin is concerned, we are dead. As far as sin is concerned, we are dead. There is therefore no more authority of sin in our life. This is legal, this is spiritual, this is actual. A parent cannot tell a dead child what to do. Well, I'm their parent. I'm that parent. I know, but they're dead. You can't tell them what to do anymore. They're dead. A police officer cannot tell a dead person what to do anymore. Person drops dead in the street. Police officer comes up and gives them a moving violation. Well, New York City, that might actually happen. The artist sticker on this corpse. Yeah, they're blocking traffic. This is unlawful. I'm sorry, you're not going to get any money out of that person. And they could care less about that law. Why? It's a real law. It's a real problem, but that person is dead. An employee, I mean a supervisor, cannot tell their employee what to do when they're dead. Hey, you call up your supervisor. Is Joe in? White man says, no, he died yesterday. He's crying. But you tell him he's late. He's going to get docked and stand firing him. What's she going to do? Hang up on the guy. He has no authority. Now, Joe is still alive. She can say, honey, you're late to work. We're going to lose our job. We're not going to get a pay to work. Oh, I got to go. And he's going to run. He's going to be scared to death. He's going to lose his job. But when he's dead, it doesn't matter anymore because there's no authority there. Right? As far as sin is concerned, you're dead. And we have to understand this. This is a theological truth. We have to get into our skulls. Right? Sin has no authority over me. I died to its authority when I believed on Jesus Christ. I entered a new frame of life. For that very reason, we shouldn't keep on sinning because our relationship to sin ended. Therefore, it's ludicrous to even think about sinning more to get more grace. It doesn't even make sense because I don't have a relationship with sin anymore. Since sin is no longer an authority over us, why is the question of 6:1 appealing to us? Why do we still consider maybe sinning a little bit more? Or have these sophisticated thoughts in our hearts, like, well, if I do this, it'll help me understand God's grace more because I'll get forgiveness later on. And I don't feel like I understand God's grace enough. I have this really squeaky clean life, so I'm going to dabble in some sin and kind of mess around a little bit. And I'll back out of it, and then God will forgive me, and that's how he is. You never, ever had thoughts like that, did you? Ever. Have. Why? Why do we have thoughts like that if we don't have a relationship with sin? We are sinners, not in the same way that we used to be. We're going to discover that in Romans chapter 6. It's because our flesh and our mind still desire to sin. Sometimes that desire is strong, and salvation doesn't take the desire away. However, we often, and this is our problem, it's a mental problem, it's an ignorance problem, we wrongly conflate desire with authority. They are not the same thing. We look and we say, I got a strong desire, urge, drive, lust, whatever, to do this sin. And then we have this theological reasoning that we go through. Well, I think God is going to do this. Why? We have a desire. But then we will say something like this. Well, push come to shove, I have to do it. Anyway, I can't resist. Wrong. Wrong. That's wrong. It is silly to say, I don't ever desire to sin. That is proud. That is arrogant. That is foolish. We still do desire to sin. But it is also wrong to say, I can't help it. I have to sin. That is also wrong. You do not have to. The desire is still present. The authority that sin has to make you do it is gone. You do it willfully. But there is no demand to give in. Before you were a Christian, you had to give in eventually. And you didn't hold out, but it's all you, and eventually you're going to give in to something. As a believer, you don't actually have to. It's willful. It's not compulsory. And that's why we have to work this passage through, and I'm going to encourage you to put it into memory, because we just don't think right. We give in to wrong thinking way too much. We feel like we have to. When it's only a desire, it's not necessary. Think about it this way. How many of you have a boss in your past that is not your boss anymore? Anyone have a boss in your past that's not your boss anymore? I have two of them. I wasn't sure who was actually in charge. The Hilltop Restaurant in high school, the husband and the wife, Bill or Susan. They were both my bosses. I don't know who was actually in charge. Whoever was in the room at the time. When they were both in the room, that was very confusing, because they both had different ideas about how to run efficient. But there were times, as a kid, as a high schooler, the phone would ring at home, and I wanted to play a video game, or I wanted to go out to eat at the buffet with my family, or go play outside, and it was my boss. It was the only job I could get in town, so I didn't have a lot of options. A town of 3,000 people. Hey, we didn't have so-and-so show up, and we need Thomas to come in and wash dishes tonight because there's no one else. And there was always this, and if he doesn't, we'll eventually find someone else because we need him. And so what would I do? I would go to work. He was my boss. I had to do that or I wouldn't have any pay. Today, if Phil or Susan Curry called me up, Thomas, we need you to come in to wash dishes tonight. And someone did. Do you think I might have some old feelings, mental thoughts, concepts, even the smell of the chicken grease and the sound of the metal washing machine going up and down, the soap suds and the bleach and all of that? Do you think I might have some of those things flood back into my mind and my emotions? Do you think I might have in that split second this little inner urge to, all right, it wouldn't last long, promise me, but that initial, yes, I'll be there. Do you think there'd be any kind of rush of that really quickly in my thoughts? Yes, there would. If you were ever in the military and an old drill instructor calls you up, you would have to work that thing for about 10 seconds because you realize this guy has no authority in my life. In the past, he could kill me, but now he has nothing. This, you're programmed. So this is how it is as Christians. The authority of sin over us is broken. It's gone. But it still comes marching around trying to see if it can fool you. And the desires are programmed. But the desires are not authority. They're just there. And that's why you need the theology in you. So that when those opportunities come, you know how to say no. Very important. You've got to have the theology embedded. You can't be ignorant. So this is what Romans 6-8 is all about. What Christian ritual or ordinance does Paul use to illustrate how this happened? There's a very important thing that Christians do that is more important than you realize. Baptism. And so he uses this ritual or this ordinance that all Christians are familiar with because you're supposed to do it right after you confess Christ. It's associated with that entering into being a Christian. It's the practice of being immersed under the water, which is why it's important. One of the reasons why we are Baptists, whether you call yourself Baptist or not is irrelevant, but one of the reasons why Baptist churches do that is because they traditionally have historically have emphasized you do need to be baptized by immersion, not sprinkling or whatever. When you sprinkle or that kind of thing, that removes the illustration that this ritual is supposed to teach and remind us of. What is this ritual supposed to remind us of? Complete burial and resurrection. Now, sometimes people were afraid to get baptized. Why? Because they're afraid of the water. Why are they afraid of the water? They wouldn't say this. They're afraid of drowning. Which, put it bluntly, they're afraid of dying in front of everybody. But that never happens. Never happens. But it's kind of that is the idea, though. Being baptized is an illustration of dying. You're going completely under. And every good pastor knows that's not the goal, so you bring them up as fast as possible. If they were a really bad sinner, you can hold them down a little longer. Get everyone nervous. No, I'm kidding. But that's the picture. Buried. And that's why, as the pastor said, buried in the what? Buried in the likeness of his death. Raised as soon as possible in the likeness of his resurrection. That's more than just a ritual. That is a reminder of what happened to you. And it should be a reminder to all of us why we shouldn't sin all the time. That's what baptism is designed to do. Now, what is the second doctrinal reason Paul offers for rejecting the opening question in Romans 6:1? One, you died with Christ. Now look at the end of verse 4. He gives another thing that happened. Not only is your relationship to sin severed, it's no longer your boss. It does not have the authority to tell you what to do, no matter how much you feel like it. What's the second one? End of verse 4. You have also been raised. And raised. Because you have a broken relationship with sin, it's as broken as a kid's relationship is to their parent when they die. That parent has no more authority anymore. Technically, if that kid came back to life, which never happens, they are free from their parents' authority. If you can find a way to die and come back to life, your parents don't have to tell you what to do anymore. Legally speaking, that's true. None of us can do that. But that's what happened with Jesus Christ. He died. We died with him. Came back to life with him. And sin is still there. And in our bodies, it's still there because our bodies haven't died. It's the part of us that hasn't died yet. Who feels that pull? But you can look at sin, you don't have any authority over it. But here's another thing that happened. You actually have a new life now, too. A new life. Not just a broken relationship with sin. You have a new life and a new obligation and a new purpose. Now, sin is not your actual authority. Your obligation is not to sin, which you were born into. You are reborn into God. Now that is your new obligation. Sin is no longer your obligation, and the law is not there to point that out. Now, your obligation is righteousness. You are obligated to do what is right. That's another reason why you shouldn't sin anymore. Broken relationship with sin, an obligation to do what is right. It's a new kind of life. New responsibility. New obligation. Not only do you have a new authority, God, but you have a new ability. Fill in the blank. God. Yeah. God now, see, sin enables you to sin. God enables you to be God. And you can be, because you have been resurrected with Jesus Christ. Final questions, and this is where we won't have an introduction next time. We will study right out of the gate. We'll split up for our questions and application. We won't spend a lot of time on them today. We'll resume that next Sunday in our groups. In what ways do you or are you tempted to excuse your sin on the basis of God's grace? And we all do this. Sometimes, somehow. Privately, publicly, a little bit, a lot. Even the most mature of us still do this a little bit.
we're not careful. What about you? Do you have any recurring sins or strong desires that you feel like you have to get into and do? But you're acting ignorantly. You're acting like you have to, and you don't. You don't. You're just letting it, and you're just continuing to go back to work every day when you have no obligation to be there whatsoever. You don't belong there. But you've just done it so much, you just feel like you don't know what else to do. Give two reasons, according to Paul, that you should not succumb to these temptations. Quickly, you do that for me. Give me two reasons why you should not. Give me Paul's reasons. Well, you died to sin and no longer has authority over you. You were raised again to a new kind of life with an obligation to do what is right. See, look at sin, you say, well, you don't even have the authority to tell me what to do. Number two, I'm supposed to do what is right because I've been resurrected by God. I have an option to my boss. I have to listen to him. So I don't know why I would listen to you. Those are the two reasons. And these reasons are going to be really developed, and that's why I'm kind of going through this. I'm not skipping anything. Paul doesn't skip anything. This is an introduction. Romans 6 through 8 is going to go into these things in more detail. In fact, this week when you study verses 5 through 7, you're going to say, didn't Pastor already say this? Didn't Paul already say this? Yes, but it needs to be said a little bit more. And so you're going to get a chance to meditate on it a little bit more. Is this theological doctrinal perspective a core influence in your mindset and approach to life? Do these things. I am dead to sin. I am alive to God. Are they ideas that govern how you're living? This last week, did those concepts affect and influence anything that you thought, said, or did? Or did you operate on other concepts? So we really have to get these into our minds. Sometimes we just really, I have to sin. That's a core teaching that we believe. We actually believe false teaching, and we live that way. That's anti-gospel, it's un-Christian, it's non-grace. It's out of touch. It's, as Paul would say, ignorance. Replace the ignorance with no fact. What is true? It's called fake news. I've got to sin. No, you desire to sin very strongly. There's a difference. You are dead to Christ. You are alive to God. That's front page news of the truth report. And that's what you need to get into your head. You can listen to the most stupid, foolish, untrue news every single day, and you would end up thinking, feeling, and looking that way because that's all you listen to. And that's what we do with our doctrine sometimes. These two doctrines deserve undivided attention. I'm dead with Christ. I dead to sin, alive with Christ. That should drive how I live every day. And the more you learn to think that way, the more you learn to live good. Have you been baptized by immersion following your conversion? If not, I can probably tell you, you're not living according to these truths. You haven't even taken the first step of identifying. I would encourage you, start 2020 by not dawdling, not putting off this core Christian ritual and ceremony that needs to be done, and remind all of us what happened to us when we got saved by doing it. Remind yourself and renew your commitments. To live Christian life. Powerful ritual.
Thank you for tuning in to the preaching ministry of Faith Baptist Church. We are conveniently located in Corona, New York City, and are devoted to loving God and making disciples. For more resources and helpful information about our church, visit studygodsword.com. We'd also like to extend a personal invitation for you and your family to worship with us on Sunday at 10 o'clock in the morning, followed by a luncheon and an uplifting time of interactive Bible study for teenagers and adults after that. If you have young children, they will really enjoy our exciting Bible-based children's ministry that also occurs in the afternoon session. If you have any questions about the church, or would like to learn more about how to have a personal relationship with God, please give us a call or leave some feedback at studygodsword.com. We would be thrilled to meet you in person and show you firsthand what God is doing at Faith Baptist Church. Until next time, may God richly bless you.